Tell us! Everyone shouted.
Langdon shrugged. Perhaps you should join the Masons or Eastern Star and learn about it from the source.
We can't get in, a young man argued. The Masons are like a super-secret society.
Super-secret? Really?
Langdon remembered the large Masonic ring that his friend Peter Solomon wore proudly on his right hand.
Then why do Masons wear obvious Masonic rings, tie clips, or pins? Why are Masonic buildings clearly marked? Why are there meeting times in the newspaper?
Langdon smiled at all the puzzled faces.
My friends, the Masons are not a secret society. They are a society with secrets.
Same thing, someone muttered.
Is it? Langdon challenged. Would you consider Coca-Cola a secret society?
Of course not, the student said.
Well, what if you knocked on the door of corporate headquarters and asked for the recipe for classic Coke?
They'd never tell you.
Exactly. In order to learn Coca-Cola's deepest secret, you would need to join the company, work for many years, prove you were trustworthy, and eventually rise to the upper echelons of the company where that information might be shared with you. Then you would be sworn to secrecy.
So you're saying Freemasonry is like a corporation?
Only insofar as they have a strict hierarchy and they take secrecy very seriously.
My uncle's a Mason, a young woman piped up, and my aunt hates it, because he won't talk about it with her. She says Masonry is some kind of strange religion.
A common misperception.
It's not a religion?
Give it the litmus test, Langdon said. Who here has taken Professor Witherspoon's comparative religion course?
Several hands went up.
Good. So tell me, what are the three prerequisites for an ideology to be considered a religion?
A, B, C, one woman offered. Assure, believe, convert.
Correct, Langdon said. Religions assure salvation, religions believe in a precise theology, and religions convert non-believers. He paused. Masonry, however, is batting 0 for 3. Masons make no promises of salvation, they have no specific theology, and they do not seek to convert you. In fact, within Masonic lodges, discussions of religion are prohibited.
So Masonry is anti-religious?
On the contrary, one of the prerequisites for becoming a Mason is that you must believe in a higher power. The difference between Masonic spirituality and organized religion is that the Masons do not impose a specific definition or name on a higher power. Rather than definitive theological identities like God, Allah, Buddha, or Jesus, the Masons use more general terms like supreme being or great architect of the universe. This enables Masons of different faiths to gather together.
Sounds a little far out, someone said.
Or perhaps refreshingly open-minded, Langdon offered.
In this age when different cultures are killing each other over whose definition of God is better, one could say the Masonic tradition of tolerance and open-mindedness is commendable.
Langdon paced the stage. Moreover, Masonry is open to men of all races, colors, and creeds, and provides a spiritual fraternity that does not discriminate in any way.
Doesn't discriminate?
A member of the university's women's center stood up.
How many women are permitted to be Masons, Professor Langdon?
Langdon showed his palms in surrender. A fair point. Freemasonry had its roots, traditionally, in the stonemasons' guilds of Europe, and was therefore a man's organization. Several hundred years ago, some say as early as 1703, a women's branch called Eastern Star was founded. They have more than 1 million members.
Nonetheless, the woman said, Masonry is a powerful organization from which women are excluded.
Langdon was not sure how powerful the Masons really were anymore, and he was not going to go down that road. Perceptions of the modern Masons ranged from their being a group of harmless old men who liked to play dress-up, all the way to an underground cabal of power brokers who ran the world. The truth, no doubt, was somewhere in the middle.
Professor Langdon, called a young man with curly hair in the back row,
if Masonry is not a secret society, not a corporation, and not a religion, then what is it?
Well, if you were to ask a Mason, he would offer the following definition. Masonry is a system of morality, veiled in allegory, and illustrated by symbols.
Sounds to me like a euphemism for freaky cult.
Freaky, you say?
Hell yes, the kid said, standing up. I heard what they do inside those secret buildings. Weird candlelight rituals with coffins and nooses and drinking wine out of skulls. Now that's freaky.
Langdon scanned the class. Does that sound freaky to anyone else?
Yes, they all chimed in.
Langdon feigned a sad sigh.
Too bad. If that's too freaky for you, then I know you'll never want to join my cult.
Silence settled over the room. The student from the women's center looked uneasy.
You're in a cult?
Langdon nodded and lowered his voice to a conspiratorial whisper. Don't tell anyone, but on the pagan day of the sun god Ra, I kneel at the foot of an ancient instrument of torture and consume ritualistic symbols of blood and flesh. The class looked horrified. Langdon shrugged. And if any of you care to join me, come to the Harvard Chapel on Sunday, kneel beneath the crucifix, and take Holy Communion. The classroom remained silent. Langdon winked. Open your minds, my friends. We all fear what we do not understand. The tolling of a clock began echoing through the Capitol corridors. 7 o'clock. Robert Langdon was now running. Talk about a dramatic entrance. Passing through the house connecting corridor, he spotted the entrance to the National Statuary Hall and headed straight for it. As he neared the door, he slowed to a nonchalant stroll and took several deep breaths. Buttoning his jacket, he lifted his chin ever so slightly and turned the corner just as the final chime sounded. Showtime. As Professor Robert Langdon strode into the National Statuary Hall, he raised his eyes and smiled warmly. An instant later, his smile evaporated. He stopped dead in his tracks. Something was very, very wrong. Chapter 7 Catherine Solomon hurried across the parking lot through the cold rain, wishing she had worn more than jeans and a cashmere sweater. As she neared the building's main entrance, the roar of the giant air purifiers got louder. She barely heard them, her ears still ringing from the phone call she'd just received. That which your brother believes is hidden in D.C., it can be found. Catherine found the notion almost impossible to believe. She and the caller still had much to discuss, and had agreed to do so later that evening. Reaching the main doors, she felt the same sense of excitement she always felt upon entering the gargantuan building. Nobody knows this place is here. The sign on the door announced, Smithsonian Museum Support Center, SMSC. The Smithsonian Institution, despite having more than a dozen massive museums on the National Mall, had a collection so huge that only 2% of it could be on display at any one time. The other 98% of the collection had to be stored somewhere, and that somewhere was here. Not surprisingly, this building was home to an astonishingly diverse array of artifacts. Giant Buddhas, handwritten codices, poisoned darts from New Guinea, jewel-encrusted knives, a kayak made of baleen. Equally mind-boggling were the building's natural treasures. Plesiosaur skeletons, a priceless meteorite collection, a giant squid, even a collection of elephant skulls brought back from an African safari by Teddy Roosevelt. But none of this was why the Smithsonian secretary, Peter Solomon, had introduced his sister to the SMSC 3 years ago. He had brought her to this place not to behold scientific marvels, but rather to create them. And that was exactly what Catherine had been doing. Deep within this building, in the darkness of the most remote recesses, was a small scientific laboratory unlike any other in the world. The recent breakthroughs Catherine had made here in the field of noetic science had ramifications across every discipline, from physics to history to philosophy to religion. Soon everything will change, she thought. As Catherine entered the lobby, the front desk guard quickly stashed his radio and yanked the earplugs from his ears. Miss Solomon, he smiled broadly. Redskins? He blushed, looking guilty. Pre-game. She smiled. I won't tell. She walked to the metal detector and emptied her pockets. When she slid the gold Cartier watch from her wrist, she felt the usual pang of sadness. The timepiece had been a gift from her mother for Catherine's 18th birthday. Almost 10 years had now passed since her mother had died violently, passing away in Catherine's arms. So, Miss Solomon, the guard whispered jokingly, are you ever going to tell anybody what you're doing back there? She glanced up. Someday, Kyle. Not tonight. Come on, he pressed. A secret lab? In a secret museum? You must be doing something cool. Miles beyond cool, Catherine thought, as she collected her things. The truth was that Catherine was doing science so advanced that it no longer even resembled science. Chapter 8 Robert Langdon stood frozen in the doorway of the National Statuary Hall and studied the startling scene before him. The room was precisely as he remembered it, a balanced semicircle built in the style of a Greek amphitheater.
The graceful arched walls of sandstone and Italian plaster were punctuated by columns of variegated breccia, interspersed with the nation's statuary collection, life-size statues of 38 great Americans standing in a semicircle on a stark expanse of black and white marble tile. It was exactly as Langdon had recalled from the lecture he had once attended here, except for one thing. Tonight, the room was empty. No chairs, no audience, no Peter Solomon. Just a handful of tourists milling around aimlessly, oblivious to Langdon's grand entrance. Did Peter mean the rotunda? He peered down the south corridor toward the rotunda and could see tourists milling around in there, too. The echoes of the clock chime had faded. Langdon was now officially late. He hurried back into the hallway and found a docent. "Excuse me, the lecture for the Smithsonian event tonight. Where is that being held?" The docent hesitated. "I'm not sure, sir. When does it start?" "Now?" The man shook his head. "I don't know about any Smithsonian event this evening. Not here, at least." Bewildered, Langdon hurried back toward the center of the room, scanning the entire space. Is Solomon playing some kind of joke? Langdon couldn't imagine it. He pulled out his cell phone and the fax page from this morning and dialed Peter's number. His phone took a moment to locate a signal inside the enormous building. Finally, it began to ring. The familiar southern accent answered.
"Peter Solomon's office. This is Anthony. May I help you?"
"Anthony," Langdon said with relief. "I'm glad you're still there. This is Robert Langdon. There seems to be some confusion about the lecture. I'm standing in the statuary hall, but there's nobody here. Has the lecture been moved to a different room?"
"I don't believe so, sir. Let me check."
His assistant paused a moment.
"Did you confirm with Mr. Solomon directly?"
Langdon was confused. "No, I confirmed with you, Anthony, this morning."
"Yes, I recall that."
There was silence on the line.
"That was a bit careless of you, don't you think, Professor?"
Langdon was now fully alert. "I beg your pardon?"
"Consider this," the man said. "You received a fax asking you to call a number, which you did. You spoke to a total stranger who said he was Peter Solomon's assistant. Then you willingly boarded a private plane to Washington and climbed into a waiting car. Is that right?"
Langdon felt a chill race through his body. "Who the hell is this? Where's Peter?"
"I'm afraid Peter Solomon has no idea you're in Washington today."
The man's southern accent disappeared, and his voice morphed into a deeper, mellifluous whisper.
"You are here, Mr. Langdon, because I want you here."
Chapter 9. Inside the statuary hall, Robert Langdon clutched his cell phone to his ear and paced in a tight circle. "Who the hell are you?" The man's reply was a silky, calm whisper.
"Do not be alarmed, Professor. You have been summoned here for a reason."
"Summoned?" Langdon felt like a caged animal. "Try kidnapped."
"Hardly."
The man's voice was eerily serene.
"If I wanted to harm you, you would be dead in your town car right now."
He let the words hang for a moment.
"My intentions are purely noble, I assure you. I would simply like to offer you an invitation."
"No thanks." Ever since his experiences in Europe over the last several years, Langdon's unwanted celebrity had made him a magnet for nutcases, and this one had just crossed a very serious line. "Look, I don't know what the hell is going on here, but I'm hanging up..."
"Unwise,"
said the man.
"Your window of opportunity is very small, if you want to save Peter Solomon's soul."
Langdon drew a sharp breath. "What did you say?"
"I'm sure you heard me."
The way this man had uttered Peter's name had stopped Langdon cold. "What do you know about Peter?"
"At this point, I know his deepest secrets. Mr. Solomon is my guest, and I can be a persuasive host."
"This can't be happening." "You don't have Peter."
"I answered his private cell phone. That should give you pause."
"I'm calling the police."
"No need,"
the man said.
"The authorities will join you momentarily."
"What is this lunatic talking about?" Langdon's tone hardened. "If you have Peter, put him on the phone right now."
"That's impossible. Mr. Solomon is trapped in an unfortunate place."
The man paused.
"He is in the Araf."
"Where?" Langdon realized he was clutching his phone so tightly his fingers were going numb.
The Araf? Amistagan? That place to which Dante devoted the canticle, immediately following his legendary inferno.
The man's religious and literary references solidified Langdon's suspicion that he was dealing with a madman. The second canticle. Langdon knew it well. Nobody escaped Phillips Exeter Academy without reading Dante. You're saying you think Peter Solomon is in purgatory?
A crude word you Christians use, but yes, Mr. Solomon is in the in-between.
The man's words hung in Langdon's ear. Are you saying Peter's dead?
Not exactly, no.
Not exactly? Langdon yelled, his voice echoing sharply in the hall. A family of tourists looked over at him. He turned away and lowered his voice. Death is usually an all-or-nothing thing.
You surprise me, Professor. I expected you to have a better understanding of the mysteries of life and death. There is a world in between, a world in which Peter Solomon is hovering at the moment. He can either return to your world, or he can move on to the next, depending on your actions right now.
Langdon tried to process this. What do you want from me?
It's simple. You have been given access to something quite ancient, and tonight you will share it with me.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No? You pretend not to understand the ancient secrets that have been entrusted to you?
Langdon felt a sudden sinking sensation, now guessing what this was probably about. Ancient secrets. He had not uttered a word to anyone about his experiences in Paris several years earlier, but Grail fanatics had followed the media coverage closely, some connecting the dots and believing Langdon was now privy to secret information regarding the Holy Grail, perhaps even its location. Look, Langdon said, if this is about the Holy Grail, I can assure you I know nothing more than—
Don't insult my intelligence, Mr. Langdon,
the man snapped.
I have no interest in anything so frivolous as the Holy Grail or mankind's pathetic debate over whose version of history is correct. Circular arguments over the semantics of faith hold no interest for me. Those are questions answered only through death.
The stark words left Langdon confused. Then what the hell is this about? The man paused for several seconds.
As you may know, there exists within this city an ancient portal.
An ancient portal?
And tonight, Professor, you will unlock it for me. You should be honored I contacted you. This is the invitation of your lifetime. You alone have been chosen.
And you have lost your mind. I'm sorry, but you've chosen poorly, Langdon said. I don't know anything about any ancient portal.
You don't understand, Professor. It was not I who chose you. It was Peter Solomon.
What? Langdon replied, his voice barely a whisper.
Mr. Solomon told me how to find the portal. And he confessed to me that only one man on earth could unlock it. And he said that man is you.
If Peter said that, he was mistaken, or lying.
I think not. He was in a fragile state when he confessed that fact, and I am inclined to believe him.
Langdon felt a stab of anger. I'm warning you, if you hurt Peter in any—
It's far too late for that,
the man said in an amused tone.
I've already taken what I need from Peter Solomon. But for his sake, I suggest you provide what I need from you. Time is of the essence for both of you. I suggest you find the portal and unlock it. Peter will point the way.
Peter? I thought you said Peter was in purgatory.
As above, so below,
the man said. Langdon felt a deepening chill. This strange response was an ancient hermetic adage that proclaimed a belief in the physical connection between heaven and earth. As above, so below. Langdon eyed the vast room and wondered how everything had veered so suddenly out of control tonight. Look, I don't know how to find any ancient portal. I'm calling the police.
It really hasn't dawned on you yet, has it? Why you were chosen?
No, Langdon said.
It will,
he replied, chuckling.
Any moment now.
Then the line went dead. Langdon stood rigid for several terrifying moments, trying to process what had just happened. Suddenly, in the distance, he heard an unexpected sound. It was coming from the rotunda. Someone was screaming. Chapter 10.
Robert Langdon had entered the Capitol Rotunda many times in his life, but never at a full sprint. As he ran through the north entrance, he spotted a group of tourists clustered in the center of the room. A small boy was screaming and his parents were trying to console him. Others were crowding around, and several security guards were doing their best to restore order.
"He pulled it out of his sling," someone said frantically, "and just left it there."
As Langdon drew nearer, he got his first glimpse of what was causing all the commotion. Admittedly, the object on the Capitol floor was odd, but its presence hardly warranted screaming. The device on the floor was one Langdon had seen many times. The Harvard Art Department had dozens of these, life-size plastic models used by sculptors and painters to help them render the human body's most complex feature, which surprisingly was not the human face, but rather the human hand. Someone left a mannequin hand in the rotunda? Mannequin hands, or handikins, as some called them, had articulated fingers, enabling an artist to pose the hand in whatever position he wanted, which for sophomore college students was often with the middle finger extended straight up in the air. This handikin, however, had been positioned with its index finger and thumb pointing up toward the ceiling. As Langdon drew nearer, though, he realized this handikin was unusual. Its plastic surface was not smooth like most. Instead, the surface was mottled and slightly wrinkled, and appeared almost like real skin. Langdon stopped abruptly. Now he saw the blood.
My God.
The severed wrist appeared to have been skewered onto a spiked wooden base so that it would stand up. A wave of nausea rushed over him. Langdon inched closer, unable to breathe, seeing now that the tips of the index finger and thumb had been decorated with tiny tattoos. The tattoos, however, were not what held Langdon's attention. His gaze moved instantly to the familiar golden ring on the fourth finger.
No.
Langdon recoiled. His world began to spin as he realized he was looking at the severed right hand of Peter Solomon. Chapter 11.
Why isn't Peter answering?
Catherine Solomon wondered as she hung up her cell phone.
Where is he?
For 3 years, Peter Solomon had always been the first to arrive for their weekly 7 p.m. Sunday night meetings. It was their private family ritual, a way to remain connected before the start of a new week, and for Peter to stay up to date on Catherine's work at the lab.
He's never late, she thought, and he always answers his phone.
To make matters worse, Catherine was still not sure what she was going to say to him when he did finally arrive.
How do I even begin to ask him about what I found out today?
Her footsteps clicked rhythmically down the cement corridor that ran like a spine through the SMSC. Known as the street, the corridor connected the building's 5 massive storage pods. 40 feet overhead, a circulatory system of orange ductwork throbbed with the heartbeat of the building, the pulsing sounds of thousands of cubic feet of filtered air being circulated. Normally, during her nearly quarter-mile walk to her lab, Catherine felt calmed by the breathing sounds of the building. Tonight, however, the pulsing had her on edge. What she had learned about her brother today would have troubled anyone, and yet because Peter was the only family she had in the world, Catherine felt especially disturbed to think he might be keeping secrets from her. As far as she knew, he had kept a secret from her only once, a wonderful secret that was hidden at the end of this very hallway. 3 years ago, her brother had walked Catherine down this corridor, introducing her to the SMSC by proudly showing off some of the building's more unusual items. The Mars meteorite, ALH-84001, the handwritten pictographic diary of Sitting Bull. A collection of wax-sealed ball jars containing original specimens collected by Charles Darwin. At one point, they walked past a heavy door with a small window. Catherine caught a glimpse of what lay beyond and gasped.
What in the world is that?
Her brother chuckled and kept walking. Pod 3, it's called Wet Pod. Pretty unusual sight, isn't it?
Terrifying is more like it.
Catherine hurried after him. This building was like another planet.
What I really want to show you is in Pod 5, her brother said, guiding her down the seemingly endless corridor. It's our newest addition. It was built to house artifacts from the basement of the National Museum of Natural History. That collection is scheduled for relocation here in about 5 years, which means Pod 5 is sitting empty at the moment.
Catherine glanced over.
Empty? So why are we looking at it?
Her brother's gray eyes flashed a familiar mischief. It occurred to me that because nobody is using the space,
maybe you could use it.
Me?
Sure. I thought maybe you could use a dedicated lab space, a facility where you can actually perform some of the theoretical experiments you've been developing for all these years. Catherine stared at her brother in shock.
But, Peter, those experiments are theoretical. To actually perform them would be almost impossible.
Nothing is impossible, Catherine, and this building is perfect for you. The SMSC is not just a warehouse of treasures. It's one of the world's most advanced scientific research facilities. We're constantly taking pieces from the collection and examining them with the best quantitative technologies money can buy. All the equipment you could possibly need would be here at your disposal.
Peter, the technologies required to run these experiments are already in place.
He smiled broadly.
The lab is done.
Catherine stopped short. Her brother pointed down the long corridor.
We're going to see it now.
Catherine could barely speak.
You built me a lab?
It's my job. The Smithsonian was established to advance scientific knowledge. As secretary, I must take that charge seriously. I believe the experiments you've proposed have the potential to push the boundaries of science into uncharted territory.
Peter stopped and looked her squarely in the eyes.
Whether or not you were my sister, I would feel obliged to support this research. Your ideas are brilliant. The world deserves to see where they lead. Peter, I can't possibly...
Okay, relax. It was my own money, and nobody's using Pod 5 right now.
When you're done with your experiments, you'll move out. Besides, Pod 5 has some unique properties that will be perfect for your work.
Catherine could not imagine what a massive empty pod might offer that would serve her research, but she sensed she was about to find out. They had just reached a steel door with boldly stenciled letters. Pod 5. Her brother inserted his keycard into a slot, and an electronic keypad lit up. He raised his finger to type his access code, but paused, arching his eyebrows in the same mischievous way he always had as a boy.
You sure you're ready?
She nodded.
My brother, always the showman.
Stand back. Peter hit the keys. The steel door hissed loudly open. Beyond the threshold was only inky blackness, a yawning void. A hollow moan seemed to echo out of the depths. Catherine felt a cold blast of air emanating from within. It was like staring into the Grand Canyon at night.
Picture an empty airline hangar waiting for a fleet of Airbuses, her brother said, and you get the basic idea.
Catherine felt herself take a step backward.
The pod itself is far too voluminous to be heated, but your lab is a thermally insulated cinder block room, roughly a cube, located in the farthest corner of the pod for maximum separation.
Catherine tried to picture it. A box inside a box. She strained to see into the darkness, but it was absolute.
How far back?
Pretty far. A football field would fit easily in here. I should warn you, though, the walk's a little unnerving. It's exceptionally dark.
Catherine peered tentatively around the corner.
No light switch? Pod 5 is not yet wired for electricity.
But then how can a lab function?
He winked.
Hydrogen fuel cell.
Catherine's jaw dropped.
You're kidding, right?
Enough clean power to run a small town. Your lab enjoys full radio frequency separation from the rest of the building. What's more, all pod exteriors are sealed with photoresistant membranes to protect the artifacts inside from solar radiation. Essentially, this pod is a sealed, energy-neutral environment.
Catherine was starting to comprehend the appeal of Pod 5. Because much of her work centered on quantifying previously unknown energy fields, her experiments needed to be performed in a location isolated from any extraneous radiation or white noise. This included interference as subtle as brain radiation or thought emissions generated by people nearby. For this reason, a university campus or hospital lab wouldn't work. But a deserted pod at the SMSC could not have been more perfect.
Let's go back and have a look.
Her brother was grinning as he stepped into the vast darkness.
Just follow me.
Catherine stalled at the threshold.
Over 100 yards in total darkness?
She wanted to suggest a flashlight, but her brother had already disappeared into the abyss.
Peter?
She called.
Leap of faith,
he called back, his voice already fading away.
You'll find your way. Trust me.
He He's kidding, right? Catherine's heart was pounding as she stepped a few feet over the threshold, trying to peer into the darkness.
I can't see a thing.
Suddenly, the steel door hissed and slammed shut behind her, plunging her into total blackness. Not a speck of light anywhere.
Peter?
Silence. You'll find your way. Trust me. Tentative, she inched forward blindly. Leap of faith? Catherine could not even see her hand directly in front of her face. She kept moving forward, but within a matter of seconds she was entirely lost.
Where am I going?
That was 3 years ago. Now, as Catherine arrived at the same heavy metal door, she realized how far she had come since that first night. Her lab, nicknamed the Cube, had become her home, a sanctuary within the depths of Pod 5. Exactly as her brother had predicted, she had found her way through the darkness that night, and every day since, thanks to an ingeniously simple guidance system that her brother had let her discover for herself. Far more important, her brother's other prediction had come true as well. Catherine's experiments had produced astonishing results, particularly in the last 6 months, breakthroughs that would alter entire paradigms of thinking. Catherine and her brother had agreed to keep her results absolutely secret until the implications were more fully understood. One day soon, however, Catherine knew she would publish some of the most transformative scientific revelations in human history. A secret lab in a secret museum, she thought, inserting her keycard into the Pod 5 door. The keypad lit up, and Catherine typed in her PIN. The steel door hissed open. The familiar hollow moan was accompanied by the same blast of cold air. As always, Catherine felt her pulse rate start to climb. Strangest commute on Earth. Steeling herself for the journey, Catherine Solomon glanced at her watch as she stepped into the void. Tonight, however, a troubled thought followed her inside.
Where is Peter?
Chapter 12. Capitol Police Chief Trent Anderson had overseen security in the U.S. Capitol complex for over a decade. A burly, square-chested man with a chiseled face and red hair, he kept his hair cropped in a buzz cut, giving him an air of military authority. He wore a visible sidearm as a warning to anyone foolish enough to question the extent of his authority. Anderson spent the majority of his time coordinating his small army of police officers from a high-tech surveillance center in the basement of the Capitol. Here he oversaw a staff of technicians who watched visual monitors, computer readouts, and a telephone switchboard that kept him in contact with the many security personnel he commanded. This evening had been unusually quiet, and Anderson was pleased. He'd been hoping to catch a bit of the Redskins game on the flat-panel television in his office. The game had just kicked off when his intercom buzzed. Chief? Anderson groaned and kept his eyes on the television as he pressed the button.
Yeah?
We've got some kind of disturbance in the rotunda. I've got officers arriving now, but I think you'll want to have a look.
Right.
Anderson walked into the Security Nerve Center, a compact neo-modern facility packed with computer monitors.
What have you got?
The technician was cueing a digital video clip on his monitor.
Rotunda, east balcony camera, 20 seconds ago.
He played the clip. Anderson watched over the technician's shoulder. The rotunda was almost deserted today, dotted with just a few tourists. Anderson's trained eye went immediately to the one person who was alone and moving faster than all the others. Shaved head, green army surplus jacket, injured arm in a sling, slight limp, slouched posture, talking on a cell phone. The bald man's footfalls echoed crisply on the audio feed until, suddenly, arriving at the exact center of the rotunda, he stopped short, ended his phone call, and then knelt down as if to tie his shoe. But instead of tying a shoe, he pulled something out of his sling and set it on the floor. Then he stood up and limped briskly toward the east exit. Anderson eyed the oddly shaped object the man had left behind.
What in the world?
It was about 8 inches tall and standing vertically. Anderson crouched closer to the screen and squinted.
That can't be what it looks like.
As the bald man hurried off, disappearing through the east portico, a little boy nearby could be heard saying,
Mommy, that man dropped something.
The boy drifted toward the object but suddenly stopped short. After a long, motionless beat, he pointed and let out a deafening scream. Instantly, the police chief spun and ran for the door, barking orders as he went.
Radio, all points. Find the bald guy with the sling and detain him, now!
Dashing out of the security center, he bounded up the treads of the well-worn staircase three at a time. The security feed had shown the bald man with the sling leave the rotunda via the east portico. The shortest route out of the building would therefore take him through the east-west corridor, which was just ahead.
I can head him off.
As he reached the top of the stairs and rounded the corner, Anderson surveyed the quiet hallway before him. An elderly couple strolled at the far end, hand in hand. Nearby, a blonde tourist wearing a blue blazer was reading a guidebook and studying the mosaic ceiling outside the house chamber.
Excuse me, sir, Anderson barked, running toward him. Have you seen a bald man with a sling on his arm?
The man looked up from his book with a confused expression.
A bald man with a sling, Anderson repeated more firmly. Have you seen him?
The tourist hesitated and glanced nervously toward the far eastern end of the hallway.
Yes, he said. I think he just ran past me to that staircase over there.
He pointed down the hall.
Anderson pulled out his radio and yelled into it, All points! The suspect is headed for the southeast exit. Converge!
He stowed the radio and yanked his sidearm from its holster, running toward the exit. 30 seconds later, at a quiet exit on the east side of the Capitol, the powerfully built blonde man in the blue blazer stepped into the damp night air. He smiled, savoring the coolness of the evening.
Transformation. It had been so easy.
Only a minute ago, he had limped quickly out of the rotunda in an army surplus coat. Stepping into a darkened alcove, he shed his coat, revealing the blue blazer he wore underneath. Before abandoning his surplus jacket, he pulled a blonde wig from the pocket and fit it snugly on his head. Then he stood up straight, pulled a slim Washington guidebook from his blazer, and stepped calmly from the niche with an elegant gait.
Transformation. This is my gift.
As Moloch's mortal legs carried him toward his waiting limousine, he arched his back, standing to his full 6'3" height and throwing back his shoulders. He inhaled deeply, letting the air fill his lungs. He could feel the wings of the tattooed phoenix on his chest opening wide.
If they only knew my power,
he thought, gazing out at the city.
Tonight, my transformation will be complete.
Moloch had played his cards artfully within the Capitol building, showing obeisance to all the ancient etiquettes.
The ancient invitation has been delivered.
If Langdon had not yet grasped his role here tonight, soon he would. Chapter 13. For Robert Langdon, the Capitol Rotunda, like St. Peter's Basilica, always had a way of taking him by surprise. Intellectually, he knew the room was so large that the Statue of Liberty could stand comfortably inside it, but somehow the rotunda always felt larger and more hallowed than he anticipated, as if there were spirits in the air. Tonight, however, there was only chaos. Capitol police officers were sealing the rotunda while attempting to herd distraught tourists away from the hand. The little boy was still crying. A bright light flashed, a tourist taking a photo of the hand, and several guards immediately detained the man, taking his camera and escorting him off. In the confusion, Langdon felt himself moving forward in a trance, slipping through the crowd, inching closer to the hand. Peter Solomon's severed right hand was standing upright, the flat plane of the detached wrist skewered down onto the spike of a small wooden stand. Three of the fingers were closed in a fist, while the thumb and index finger were fully extended, pointing up toward the soaring dome.
"Everyone back!" an officer called.
Langdon was close enough now that he could see dried blood, which had run down from the wrist and coagulated on the wooden base. Post-mortem wounds don't bleed, which means Peter is alive. Langdon didn't know whether to be relieved or nauseated. Peter's hand was removed while he was alive? Bile rose in his throat. He thought of all the times his dear friend had extended this same hand to shake Langdon's or offer a warm embrace. For several seconds, Langdon felt his mind go blank, like an untuned television set, broadcasting only static. The first clear image that broke through was utterly unexpected. A crown and a star. Langdon crouched down, eyeing the tips of Peter's thumb and index finger.
Tattoos?
Incredibly, the monster who had done this appeared to have tattooed tiny symbols on Peter's fingertips. On the thumb, a crown, on the index finger, a star.
This can't be.
The two symbols registered instantly in Langdon's mind, amplifying this already horrific scene into something almost otherworldly. These symbols had appeared together many times in history, and always in the same place, on the fingertips of a hand. It was one of the ancient world's most coveted and secretive icons, the Hand of the Mysteries. The icon was rarely seen anymore, but throughout history it had symbolized a powerful call to action. Langdon strained to comprehend the grotesque artifact now before him. Someone crafted the Hand of the Mysteries out of Peter's hand? It was unthinkable. Traditionally, the icon was sculpted in stone or wood or rendered as a drawing. Langdon had never heard of the Hand of the Mysteries being fashioned from actual flesh. The concept was abhorrent. "Sir," a guard said behind Langdon, "please step back." Langdon barely heard him. There are other tattoos. Although he could not see the fingertips of the three clenched fingers, Langdon knew these fingertips would bear their own unique markings. That was the tradition. 5 symbols in total. Through the millennia, the symbols on the fingertips of the Hand of the Mysteries had never changed, nor had the hand's iconic purpose. The hand represents an invitation. Langdon felt a sudden chill as he recalled the words of the man who had brought him here. "Professor, tonight you are receiving the invitation of your lifetime." In ancient times, the Hand of the Mysteries actually served as the most coveted invitation on earth. To receive this icon was a sacred summons to join an elite group, those who were said to guard the secret wisdom of all the ages. The invitation not only was a great honor, but it signified that a master believed you were worthy to receive this hidden wisdom. The hand of the master extended to the initiate. "Sir," the guard said, putting a firm hand on Langdon's shoulder, "I need you to back up right now."
"I know what this means," Langdon managed. "I can help you."
"Now," the guard said.
"My friend is in trouble. We have to..."
Langdon felt powerful arms pulling him up and leading him away from the hand. He simply let it happen, feeling too off balance to protest. A formal invitation had just been delivered. Someone was summoning Langdon to unlock a mystical portal that would unveil a world of ancient mysteries and hidden knowledge. But it was all madness. Delusions of a lunatic. Chapter 14. Moloch's stretch limousine eased away from the U.S. Capitol, moving eastward down Independence Avenue. A young couple on the sidewalk strained to see through the tinted rear windows, hoping to glimpse a VIP.
"I'm in front," Moloch thought,
smiling to himself. Moloch loved the feeling of power he got from driving this massive car all alone. None of his other 5 cars offered him what he needed tonight, the guarantee of privacy, total privacy. Limousines in this city enjoyed a kind of unspoken immunity. Embassies on wheels. Police officers who worked near Capitol Hill were never certain what power broker they might mistakenly pull over in a limousine, and so most simply chose not to take the chance. As Moloch crossed the Anacostia River into Maryland, he could feel himself moving closer to Catherine, pulled onward by destiny's gravity.
"I am being called to a second task tonight, one I had not imagined."
Last night, when Peter Solomon told the last of his secrets, Moloch had learned of the existence of a secret lab in which Catherine Solomon had performed miracles, staggering breakthroughs that Moloch realized would change the world if they were ever made known.
"Her work will unveil the true nature of all things."
For centuries, the brightest minds on earth had ignored the ancient sciences, mocking them as ignorant superstitions, arming themselves instead with smug skepticism and dazzling new technologies. Tools that led them only further from the truth.
"Every generation's breakthroughs are proven false by the next generation's technology."
And so it had gone through the ages. The more man learned, the more he realized he did not know. For millennia, mankind had wandered in the darkness. But now, as had been prophesied, there was a change coming. After hurtling blindly through history, mankind had reached a crossroads. This moment had been predicted long ago, prophesied by the ancient texts, by the primeval calendars, and even by the stars themselves. The date was specific, its arrival imminent. It would be preceded by a brilliant explosion of knowledge, a flash of clarity to illuminate the darkness and give mankind a final chance to veer away from the abyss and take the path of wisdom.
"I have come to obscure the light," Moloch thought. This is my role.
Fate had linked him to Peter and Catherine Solomon. The breakthroughs Catherine Solomon had made within the SMSC would risk opening floodgates of new thinking, starting a new renaissance. Catherine's revelations, if made public, would become a catalyst that would inspire mankind to rediscover the knowledge he had lost, empowering him beyond all imagination.
Catherine's destiny is to light this torch. Mine is to extinguish it.
Chapter 15. In total darkness, Catherine Solomon groped for the outer door of her lab. Finding it, she heaved open the lead-lined door and hurried into the small entry room. The journey across the void had taken only 90 seconds, and yet her heart was pounding wildly.
After 3 years, you'd think I'd be used to that.
Catherine always felt relieved to escape the blackness of Pod 5 and step into this clean, well-lit space. The cube was a massive windowless box. Every inch of the interior walls and ceiling was covered with a stiff mesh of titanium-coated lead fiber, giving the impression of a giant cage built inside a cement enclosure. Dividers of frosted plexiglass separated the space into different compartments. A laboratory, a control room, a mechanical room, a bathroom, and a small research library. Catherine strode briskly into the main lab. The bright and sterile workspace glistened with advanced quantitative equipment. Paired electroencephalographs, a femtosecond comb, a magneto-optical trap, and quantum indeterminate electronic noise REGs, more simply known as random event generators. Despite Noetic Science's use of cutting-edge technologies, the discoveries themselves were far more mystical than the cold, high-tech machines that were producing them. The stuff of magic and myth was fast becoming reality, as the shocking new data poured in, all of it supporting the basic ideology of Noetic Science, the untapped potential of the human mind. The overall thesis was simple. We have barely scratched the surface of our mental and spiritual capabilities. Experiments at facilities like the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, in California, and the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, PEAR, had categorically proven that human thought, if properly focused, had the ability to affect and change physical mass. Their experiments were no spoon-bending parlor tricks, but rather highly controlled inquiries that all produced the same extraordinary result. Our thoughts actually interacted with the physical world, whether or not we knew it, affecting change all the way down to the subatomic realm. Mind over matter. In 2001, in the hours following the horrifying events of September 11th, the field of noetic science made a quantum leap forward. Four scientists discovered that as the frightened world came together and focused in shared grief on this single tragedy, the outputs of 37 different random event generators around the world suddenly became significantly less random. Somehow, the oneness of this shared experience, the coalescing of millions of minds, had affected the randomizing function of these machines, organizing their outputs and bringing order from chaos. The shocking discovery, it seemed, paralleled the ancient spiritual belief in a cosmic consciousness, a vast coalescing of human intention that was actually capable of interacting with physical matter. Recently, studies in mass meditation and prayer had produced similar results in random event generators, fueling the claim that human consciousness, as noetic author Lynn McTaggart described it, was a substance outside the confines of the body, a highly ordered energy capable of changing the physical world. Catherine had been fascinated by McTaggart's book, The Intention Experiment, and her global web-based study, theintentionexperiment.com, aimed at discovering how human intention could affect the world. A handful of other progressive texts had also piqued Catherine's interest. From this foundation, Catherine Solomon's research had vaulted forward, proving that focused thought could affect literally anything. The growth rate of plants, the direction that fish swam in a bowl, the manner in which cells divided in a petri dish, the synchronization of separately automated systems, and the chemical reactions in one's own body. Even the crystalline structure of a newly forming solid was rendered mutable by one's mind. Catherine had created beautifully symmetrical ice crystals by sending loving thoughts to a glass of water as it froze. Incredibly, the converse was also true. When she sent negative, polluting thoughts to the water, the ice crystals froze in chaotic, fractured forms. Human thought can literally transform the physical world. As Catherine's experiments grew bolder, her results became more astounding. Her work in this lab had proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that mind over matter was not just some New Age self-help mantra.
The mind had the ability to alter the state of matter itself. And, more important,
the mind had the power to encourage the physical world to move in a specific direction. We are the masters of our own universe. At the subatomic level, Catherine had shown that particles themselves came in and out of existence based solely on her intention to observe them. In a sense, her desire to see a particle manifested that particle. Heisenberg had hinted at this reality decades ago, and now it had become a fundamental principle of noetic science. In the words of Lynn McTaggart, living consciousness somehow is the influence that turns the possibility of something into something real. The most essential ingredient in creating our universe is the consciousness that observes it. The most astonishing aspect of Catherine's work, however, had been the realization that the mind's ability to affect the physical world could be augmented through practice. Intention was a learned skill. Like meditation, harnessing the true power of thought required practice.
More important, some people were born more skilled at it than others.
And throughout history, there had been those few who had become true masters. This is the missing link between modern science and ancient mysticism. Catherine had learned this from her brother Peter, and now, as her thoughts turned back to him, she felt a deepening concern. She walked to the lab's research library and peered in. Empty. The library was a small reading room, two Morris chairs, a wooden table, two floor lamps, and a wall of mahogany bookshelves that held some 500 books. Catherine and Peter had pooled their favorite texts here, writings on everything from particle physics to ancient mysticism. Their collection had grown into an eclectic fusion of new and old, of cutting edge and historical. Most of Catherine's books bore titles like Quantum Consciousness, The New Physics, and Principles of Neural Science. Her brothers bore older, more esoteric titles, like The Kybalion, The Zohar, The Dancing Wu Li Masters, and a translation of the Sumerian tablets from the British Museum. The key to our scientific future, her brother often said, is hidden in our past. A lifelong scholar of history, science, and mysticism, Peter had been the first to encourage Catherine to boost her university science education with an understanding of early Hermetic philosophy. She had been only 19 years old when Peter sparked her interest in the link between modern science and ancient mysticism.
So tell me, Kate, her brother had asked while she was home on vacation during her sophomore year at Yale, what are Eli's reading these days in theoretical physics?
Catherine had stood in her family's book-filled library and recited her demanding reading list.
Impressive, her brother replied. Einstein, Bohr, and Hawking are modern geniuses. But are you reading anything older?
Catherine scratched her head.
You mean like Newton?
He smiled. Keep going. At 27, Peter had already made a name for himself in the academic world, and he and Catherine had grown to savor this kind of playful intellectual sparring.
Older than Newton?
Catherine's head now filled with distant names like Ptolemy, Pythagoras,
and Hermes Trismegistus.
Nobody reads that stuff anymore. Her brother ran a finger down the long shelf of cracked leather bindings and old, dusty tomes. The scientific wisdom of the ancients was staggering. Modern physics is only now beginning to comprehend it all.
Peter, she said, you already told me that the Egyptians understood levers and pulleys long before Newton, and that the early alchemists did work on a par with modern chemistry, but so what? Today's physics deals with concepts that would have been unimaginable to the ancients.
Like what?
Well, like entanglement theory, for one.
Subatomic research had now proven categorically that all matter was interconnected, entangled in a single unified mesh, a kind of universal oneness.
You're telling me that the ancients sat around discussing entanglement theory?
Absolutely. Peter said, pushing his long, dark bangs out of his eyes. Entanglement was at the core of primeval beliefs. Its names are as old as history itself. Dharmakaya, Tao, Brahman. In fact, man's oldest spiritual quest was to perceive his own entanglement, to sense his own interconnection with all things. He has always wanted to become one with the universe, to achieve the state of at-one-ment. Her brother raised his eyebrows. To this day, Jews and Christians still strive for atonement, although most of us have forgotten it is actually at-one-ment we're seeking. Catherine sighed, having forgotten how hard it was to argue with a man so well-versed in history.
Okay, but you're talking in generalities. I'm talking specific physics.
Then be specific. His keen eyes challenged her now.
Okay, how about something as simple as polarity? The positive-negative balance of the subatomic realm. Obviously, the ancients didn't understand.
Hold on! Her brother pulled down a large, dusty text, which he dropped loudly on the library table.
Modern polarity is nothing but the dual world described by Krishna here in the Bhagavad Gita over 2,000 years ago. A dozen other books in here, including the Kybalion, talk about binary systems and the opposing forces in nature.
Catherine was skeptical.
Okay, but if we talk about modern discoveries in subatomics, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, for example,
then we must look here, Peter said, striding down his long bookshelf and pulling out another text.
The sacred Hindu Vedantic scriptures, known as the Upanishads.
He dropped the tome heavily on the first.
Heisenberg and Schrödinger studied this text and credited it with helping them formulate some of their theories.
The showdown continued for several minutes, and the stack of dusty books on the desk grew taller and taller. Finally, Catherine threw up her hands in frustration.
Okay, you made your point, but I want to study cutting-edge theoretical physics, the future of science. I really doubt Krishna or Vyasa had much to say about superstring theory and multidimensional cosmological models.
You're right, they didn't. Her brother paused, a smile crossing his lips.
If you're talking superstring theory,
he wandered over to the bookshelf yet again,
then you're talking this book here.
He heaved out a colossal leather-bound book and dropped it with a crash onto the desk.
13th-century translation of the original medieval Aramaic. Superstring theory in the 13th century?
Catherine wasn't buying it.
Come on.
Superstring theory was a brand-new cosmological model. Based on the most recent scientific observations, it suggested that the multidimensional universe was made up not of three, but rather of 10 dimensions, which all interacted like vibrating strings, similar to resonating violin strings. Catherine waited as her brother heaved open the book, ran through the ornately printed table of contents, and then flipped to a spot near the beginning of the book.
Read this.
He pointed to a faded page of text and diagrams.
Dutifully, Catherine studied the page. The translation was old-fashioned and very hard to read,
but to her utter amazement, the text and drawings clearly outlined the exact same universe heralded by modern superstring theory, a 10-dimensional universe of resonating strings. As she continued reading, she suddenly gasped and recoiled.
My God, it even describes how six of the dimensions are entangled and act as one.
She took a frightened step backward.
What is this book?
Her brother grinned. Something I'm hoping you'll read one day. He flipped back to the title page, where an ornately printed plate bore three words. The Complete Zohar. Although Catherine had never read the Zohar, she knew it was the fundamental text of early Jewish mysticism, once believed so potent that it was reserved only for the most erudite rabbis. Catherine eyed the book.
You're saying the early mystics knew their universe had 10 dimensions?
Absolutely. He motioned to the page's illustration of 10 intertwined circles called Sfirot. Obviously the nomenclature is esoteric, but the physics is very advanced. Catherine didn't know how to respond.
But then why don't more people study this?
Her brother smiled.
They will. I don't understand.
Catherine, we have been born into wonderful times. A change is coming.
Human beings are poised on the threshold of a new age when they will begin turning their eyes back to nature and to the old ways. Back to the ideas in books like the Zohar and other ancient texts from around the world. Powerful truth has its own gravity and eventually pulls people back to it. There will come a day when modern science begins in earnest to study the wisdom of the ancients.
That will be the day that mankind begins to find answers to the big questions that still elude him. That night, Catherine eagerly began reading her brother's ancient texts and quickly came to understand that he was right. The ancients possessed profound scientific wisdom. Today's science was not so much making discoveries as it was making rediscoveries. Mankind, it seemed, had once grasped the true nature of the universe, but had let go and forgotten.
Modern physics can help us remember.
This quest had become Catherine's mission in life. To use advanced science to rediscover the lost wisdom of the ancients. It was more than academic thrill that kept her motivated. Beneath it all was her conviction that the world needed this understanding, now more than ever. At the rear of the lab, Catherine saw her brother's white lab